he notices that consciousness is actually a stream of consciousness. It's made up of these discrete moments, these bits, particles, not waves, to use a physics analogy, right? And so he wonders, how long is the now? How long are these particles?
What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm-shifting, nothing-is-ever-the-same-again breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance, so you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Darris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio.
Welcome to a special episode of Flow Research Collective Radio. We've actually pulled a section from one of Stephen's audiobooks called Mapping Cloud 9, and the subtitle is Neuroscience, Flow, and the Upper Possibility Space of Human Experience. Big kudos to Stephen for that title. I think it's my favorite title of any of his books, and that's definitely saying something. He's phenomenal at creating sticky book titles at this point. But regardless, in Mapping Cloud 9, Stephen goes far and wide. His overarching intention in that book is to bridge science and spirituality and to explore how our understanding of peak experiences have evolved over time. Stephen covers early inquiries into altered and mystical states. He talks about the birth of positive psychology and research on high performers. He talks about pioneering studies on meditation and near-death experiences, as well as current explorations of psychedelics, flow states, and technological breakthroughs that relate to this field. Now, today we've got the whole of Chapter 1 of Mapping Cloud 9 as a special treat for you. And you're going to learn about the likes of Friedrich Nietzsche and William James as the first peak performance philosophers, and why Stephen believes they were peak performance philosophers in the first place. Stephen's also going to talk about the fact that the history of flow research took a weird turn. So you're going to have to stay tuned to hear about the details of that. But my hope is that this snippet from Stephen's book, Mapping Cloud 9, really inspires you to leverage the growing body of flow research and to use it for yourself and your own life to step into new realms of possibility. Now, as this segment from Mapping Cloud 9 focuses on flow research, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our program, the Flow Trainer Accelerator, which is our deepest dive into flow research here at the Collective. So here's the thing, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to differentiate yourself as a coach or a service provider. I don't know if your Instagram or Facebook feed looks like mine, but at least from what I can see, everyone is a coach these days. And with the increasing uncertainty of our world, succeeding within the coaching game requires deeper expertise, more rigorous scientific backing, and more mastery over your craft than ever before. And that's why we've built the Flow Trainer Accelerator. It is a program designed specifically for coaches, consultants and service providers, or aspiring coaches who want to develop expertise in flow science and master a framework for coaching flow and peak performance. And the Flow Trainer Accelerator is designed around four main pillars. The first thing that we do is focus on your own individual performance. We level up your game, we improve your ability to harness flow so that you can accelerate the results you're creating in your own life, and of course, so that you're practicing what you preach. If you're going to be teaching others and coaching others on flow and peak performance, you got to be leaning into your own edge as well. The second pillar involves turning you into a domain expert on the science of flow states. We've packed an entire master's degree worth of resources into this training so that you can emerge out the other side of the Flow Trainer Accelerator, able to speak about the science of peak performance and flow with authority, confidence, and clarity, as you're going to hear Stephen do in Mapping Cloud 9 today. Now, the third thing we're aiming to do with the Flow Trainer Accelerator is level up your skills in the art of coaching. We give you everything needed, from a full understanding of the fundamentals of coaching through to the framework that we have developed for coaching flow here at the Flow Research Collective, which gives you step-by-step maps and models that you can apply directly within coaching interactions. Finally, joining the Flow Trainer Accelerator means joining a network of like-minded peak performers who are aspiring to be more, do more, and serve at a higher level. This network's going to level you up. It's going to hold you accountable. It's going to involve folks who will have your back when you need that, provide you with feedback, challenge you, and support you on your journey. So, if this is of interest to you, if you're a mission-driven, craft-focused coach, we do not want certification junkies. We don't want folks who want to make a quick buck in the coaching industry or want to just add another line to their LinkedIn bio. We want folks who are craft-focused and care about producing results for their clients. But if that is you, you can apply for the Flow Trainer Accelerator at flowforcoaches.com. That's flowforcoaches.com, with the four being F-O-R rather than the number. And we're capping our current cohort at 50 spots, which we're expecting to pack out pretty fast. So again, if this is of interest, I encourage you to dash over to flowforcoaches.com and apply right there. Now with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Stephen today for this special excerpt out of his audiobook, Mapping Cloud 9. I hope you totally dig it. I think you will.
I want to give you three examples of what I saw happening, because what I was actually witnessing was nearly exponential growth in ultimate human performance. Now, ultimate human performance is technically defined as performance when life or limb is on the line. And from an evolutionary perspective, it should be the slowest growth category, right? It should not explode at any one particular point in time. And yet this was happening. And let me give you a couple examples. Easy one is snowboarding. So in 1996, the biggest gap jump anybody had ever cleared on a snowboard was the Baker Road Gap in Mount Washington. And the Baker Road Gap is big. It's built over a highway and it's 40 feet. So snowboarders were essentially jumping two buses stacked back to back in 1996. And that was huge and really, really big. And people thought you could edge it up, maybe go 60 feet or 80 feet. It was then believed that above 80 feet, no human being could land. Couldn't do it on skis, couldn't do it on a snowboard, just wasn't actually possible. Well, here we are, less than two decades later, and snowboarders can now clear almost 300 feet worth of a gap jump. So we have gone in less than two decades from jumping two buses to jumping a skyscraper. Surfing is another example. This is a 1,000-year-old sport. And from 400 AD until 1992, progress had been really slow. 25 feet was the biggest wave anybody had ever surfed. There are actually physics papers written about how you cannot paddle into a wave over 25 feet. And it's really simple. The waves just move too fast to paddle into. Well, today, surfers are routinely paddling into waves that are 60, 80, 100 feet big, right? This is nearly exponential growth in ultimate human performance. I'm going to tell you my favorite story of this because it's still amazing to me. So in 2012, a rock climber named Alex Honnold free soloed Half Dome. Now, Half Dome is in Yosemite in California, and it is a huge wall. It takes most climbers a day and a half, and they climb in pairs, and they bring ropes, and they bring equipment, and they bring gear, and they bring portal edges, and they sleep on the side of the wall, and it's a big production. 2012, Alex Honnold free soloed Half Dome. Free solo means he climbed without rope, he climbed out without protection. If he fell, he died. That simple. He climbed Half Dome in an hour and 22 minutes. It is the rough equivalent of running a 4-minute mile in 43 seconds, right? So back then, when I was watching all this happen, it was weirder than it sounds, even though it sounds really strange, because these were my friends. These weren't strangers I was reading about in magazines or watching on television. These were guys I was drinking with. You know, you'd go out in the evening, you'd have a couple beers with Shane, and you'd go out the next morning, and Shane would do something nobody in the history of the world had ever done before and didn't look possible. And that really spun my head around. I want to know what the hell was going on. But more importantly, and this isn't the case now, but back in the early 1990s, action adventure sport athletes were a really rowdy, irreverent, punk rock group of people with very few natural advantages. So most of the people I knew came from really broken homes, had horrific, horrific childhoods. Many of them single parent homes, sometimes no parents, very, very, very little education as well, and almost no money. And yet here these people were reinventing what was possible for our species. on a semi-regular basis. And I wanted to know what the hell was going on. But I had also broken 82 bones, and I knew if I didn't take my question out of action sports, I was going to die. I was going to kill myself along the way. So that's essentially what I did. And I have written essentially 10 books about what I discovered along the way. And I've looked at this question of what does it take to do the impossible? So high performance, the peak of high performance. We're talking about the science of high performance. That's one of the lineages. This was my introduction to that science. And I looked at it first in action sports very deeply. But then, for example, my book Tomorrowland is an investigation. I spent roughly 20 years investigating those maverick scientists who took science fiction ideas and turned them into science fact technology. So whether this was the invention of the flying car or the very first bionic eye, the artificial vision system that was ever turned on, or the very first private space launch, or on and on. In my book, Bold, I looked at really maverick businessmen, Larry Page, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Richard Branson, people who have built world-changing companies, often in areas where people didn't even think you could start a company, right? When Richard Branson started Virgin Airlines, everybody said it was a horrific idea, that there was no room in the airlines for his ideas, on and on and on and on. So impossible business feats in abundance, where I teamed up with my friend Peter Diamandis, the founder of the XPRIZE and the co-founder of Singularity University in Silicon Valley, where they study the application of exponentially accelerating technology to solving the world's grand challenges. And we wrote a book called Abundance about individuals and small teams of people going after impossible global challenges, poverty, healthcare, energy scarcity, those sorts of questions, water shortages, and individuals succeeding, where 20 years ago, large corporations and big governments were the only people going after these problems were actually failing. And everywhere I went, I asked the question of how is this possible? What are we seeing? And one of the answers, and it's going to be an answer that we're going to spend a lot of time on, so I want to start here to just give you a definition and a look at what we're talking about. Whenever you see the impossible become possible, you see a state of consciousness known to researchers as flow. And I want to define flow for you, and this is not my definition. This is a technical scientific definition. It was originally coined by a man named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. We're going to talk more about him later, but it is defined as an optimal state of consciousness. It is a state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. More specifically, we've all had this experience. It refers to those moments of rapt attention and total absorption. We get so focused on the task at hand that everything else just disappears, right? Our concentration gets so intense in the right here, right now, that action and awareness will start to merge. Time will pass strangely. The technical term for this is time dilation. What that means is sometimes, occasionally, it'll slow down. You get that freeze frame effect from anybody who's been in a car crash or seen The Matrix, right? What they now call bullet time. More frequently, much more commonly, time speeds up and 5 hours go by in like 5 minutes. And this is the experience we've all had when you sit down to write that quickie email, right? And you look up an hour later and you realize you've written a long essay. That's a light grade micro flow state, but that's just a taste of sort of time dilation. Sense of self disappears as well, and our inner critic, that nagging, always on, defeatist voice in our head, goes very, very silent in flow. Now, when we talk about flow, and I will be talking about it extensively later on, this is exactly what I'm talking about, and underneath everything I'm describing, there is a very precise physiological and neurobiological signature. So physiological, there's what's going on in the body. So what's your heart doing? What's your skin doing? Those kinds of responses, right? Galvanic skin response, which is basically sweating. It's a fear response. That's a physiological signal. Neurobiological signals, EEG, fMRI, so anything that measures brain waves or brain activity, those are the things that I'm talking about here. And so a lot of what we're going to do over the next 6 to 8 hours, right, when we walk through this voyage of discovery where people literally sort of mapped human consciousness for the very first time scientifically. Obviously, in Eastern traditions, they have been mapping human consciousness from a different perspective for thousands of years, and there are obviously Western magical traditions, mystical traditions, where the same thing has been going on, but scientifically, it's the past 150 years. And flow, was a huge key, and you'll understand why as we go along. But the most important thing to know is while flow is a state of consciousness that is really, really well defined physiologically, neurobiologically, psychologically, in fact, psychologically, this is the core definition that is used when we define flow. So when psychologists and scientists talk about flow, they're talking about the neurobiological signature and the psychological signature, but the state has core psychological characteristics. And I listed a bunch of these for you a second ago. Uninterrupted concentration in the present moment, the vanishing of self, time passing strangely, loss of bodily awareness is another one, an increased sense of control that I have more impact over events, and so forth. There were 10 of them originally. This has shrunk down to 7 now, and there are 5 or 6 extremely well-established psychometric instruments that measure these characteristics. So when I talk about flow, I'm talking about something that's very specifically psychological, neurobiological, and physiological, but until the 1950s, and we'll come back to this story later, everybody thought flow was a mystical experience. In fact, they thought it was an experience only spiritual and religious people got to have. So when I say that the science of spirituality and the science of high performance started out together, this is what I mean. We now define flow as a state of ultimate human performance, right? It's different from a spiritual peak state in how we think about it. But 100 years ago, it wasn't. We thought they were the same thing. And we'll talk about what's different, what's the same. We'll go into all of this. But when we talk about the science of spirituality and the science of high performance on a dark and stormy night, this is what I mean. It was all mashed together, and we just didn't know. And finally, before we sort of jump into the sort of the core text of the heart of Mapping Cloud 9, I want to talk a little bit about why I wrote this book and where it came from. I have a little bit of an agenda, and I like to be transparent about my agenda. And the first thing I want you to know is that as a writer, I'm trained as a new journalist, and this is a very specific approach to the truth. New journalism emerged in the late 50s and 1960s. It's writers like Joan Didion, Hunter S. Thompson, John McPhee. And the idea here is really simple, but it's kind of important to our project, which is that coming out of the 50s, it was really clear to a lot of like newspaper writers and magazine writers that in the editing process, truth was getting fucked with. We were messing with the truth. This wasn't like Noam Chomsky and his big conspiracy theories. This was, hey, I'm the writer. I choose fact A and B over C and D. And my editor comes along and he likes A more than B, so he asks me to develop A, and things get cut out. And then there's a top editor on top of that, and then there's an editor-in-chief and a publisher and so forth. And what happens is the truth gets distorted. So new journalists fought back by putting so much of themselves in the story, you always knew where they were coming from. So you always knew what their biases were. So you always knew why they were selecting the facts they were selecting. That was the whole point. So I am a new journalist, which means I'm going to tell you a little bit about me and where I'm coming from in a second. The other thing I want to tell you is I want to talk a little bit about what I call a truth filter. So a truth filter is, how do I know something I'm telling you is true? So as a reporter, the standard truth filter is, if I've got a fact and I can get 3 experts to support my fact, good deal. I can publish it. Excellent. True story, and we're going to hear about this research a little bit later. Years ago, I was writing a story on the neuroscience of out-of-body and near-death experiences, and I was stunned by how much science had actually discovered about these experiences. And we're going to walk through that later, and you'll get to share in this excitement. But at the time, I was like, how the hell is this not common knowledge? Why doesn't everybody know this? And so I started asking the scientists I was interviewing. And the guy I was talking to said, oh, the problem was these 2 people, person X and person Y, wrote these really popular books on it, and they're not really scientific, and they sort of ruined it for the rest of us. And I went, oh, okay, that's great. And I fact-checked this particular fact with 3 other experts, and they gave me the exact same name for X and the exact same name for Y. So I had initial fact, and I had 3 confirmations, and fantastic, and we published it. And it turns out every single person who gave me this fact got the name of one of the book authors wrong. And instead of giving me the name of the correct book author who had wrote a very popular book on the pseudoscience of out-of-body experience, they gave me Charles Tart's name. Charles Tart is one of the most vaunted, lauded, altered state scientific researchers ever. And they got everything wrong. Literally everything they told me, they got wrong. And the magazine got a very angry phone call from Mr. Tart. And I was very, very apologetic. And from that moment on, I realized that was not good enough. So every fact in here has been checked with a minimum of five people. And I'll tell you something interesting, by the way, if you ever want to play this game, I have found that if you ask five people if a particular fact is true, four will usually say yes, and the fifth person will actually tend to tell you something that contradicts what the previous four have told you, and then you have to start over and talk to five more. But that's my truth filter.
Hey there, this is Rian again. I hope you've been enjoying Mapping Cloud 9. I always get a blast from hearing Stephen go into this material in depth. Now, I wanted to remind you that if you're a coach, a consultant, or a service provider, and you want to become an expert in the science of peak performance so you can coach your clients in flow, then our coaching program, the Flow Trainer Accelerator, may be a fit. We're capping our current cohort at 50 people, and we're looking only for mission-driven, craft, and client-focused coaches. Now, if that is you, and this is of interest to you, then go to flowforcoaches.com and apply for the Flow Trainer Accelerator there. That's flowforcoaches.com if you want to apply to learn to coach flow with us here at the Flow Research Collective. Now, let's dive back over to Stephen.
So everything we're going to be talking about today, so you know how accurate I want it to be, that's how I'm applying it. I also want you, as a new journalist, to know a little bit about where I'm coming from, who I am. When I was 19 years old, I dropped out of college, moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, because the new age was booming. And over the next X amount of years, there was shamans and crystals and ashrams and monasteries and astrology and tarot and psychedelics and more psychedelics. And by the time it was all said and done, I could sit in the full lotus for 6 to 8 hours at a time. I could chant in Sanskrit for 4 or 5 hours at a time. And I never once had a mystical experience of any kind. Nothing interesting ever happened to me. And I was such a frustrated seeker that I spun it around and I went into the science of spiritual experience and mystical experience and flow states, trying to find answers to the questions that I could not find on a spiritual path. So I tend to be a little dismissive of some of the spiritual ideas, and you're going to hear nothing over the next 6 to 8 hours that is going to confirm your belief in Sky Dad. That's not where I'm coming from. But now at least you know why I feel the way I feel, right? And I will also say that even though I am a hardcore science guy, I'm a hardcore science guy who's had a 20-year Ashtanga yoga practice and a 25-year meditation practice. So, and most of that is breath or mantra meditation, though I will say, a friend of mine who's a Tibetan Lama told me that when he first got to Tibet, they locked him in a cave and said, for the next 7 months, I want you to contemplate what it's like to have 11 heads and 1,000 hands. 11 heads so you can see from multiple perspectives, and 1,000 hands so you can help as many people as possible. So I will tell you that I have been trying this particular meditation for the past 8 months, and I can get the head or the hands. I can't get them both at once. So I have a little bit of what you would call a spiritual practice, but as I said, I am not a guy who believes in Sky Dad at all. But I am a guy who believes that the path to peak performance is a spiritual path. And I'm also somebody who cringes when they say a word like spiritual path. So I'm going to spend the next 8 hours sort of proving to you, or at least to myself, that I can use that word out loud and mean something by it. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about my agenda, why I'm doing all this. And the reason I'm doing all this, and especially with Sounds True and this partnership with Sounds True, is Sounds True's audience is much more spiritual than the scientists who I deal with on a daily basis or the people I encounter at the Flow Genome Project. And even though I think that in the spiritual community there is very, very sloppy language and very, very sloppy thinking, way, way, way too much, I also know that the field that I am most passionate about, which is studying the science of spirituality and studying the science of human performance, the greatest leaps forward over the past 50 years, maybe the past 150 years, have been when scientists got together with people from the spiritual traditions and we bridged that gap. So a lot of what I'm trying to do over the next 6 to 8 hours is say, hey, there are really big questions out there. There are people with deep spiritual practices who have all kinds of knowledge bases that the scientists are never going to have access to. But if you can't learn a little bit of the language of science, we're never going to listen to what you have to say. So I'm trying to bridge the gap a little bit. I'm extending a knowledge branch from the science side across the bow, and maybe somebody on the other side will pick it up and advance us a little bit farther for us. And what we're going to do all that in Mapping Cloud 9 is we're going to focus on 5 different transformational epochs. We're going to sort of start with what I think of as the actualization of self-actualization, or this is sort of the era that goes from Friedrich Nietzsche to Carl Jung, where a lot of the foundational ideas about science and the science of spirituality and the science of high performance were laid down for the first time. Then we're going to jump in. The second era is what I call the mystical split. It starts with Abraham Maslow, and this is where science and spirituality actually split apart. And we're going to track the science of high performance sort of from Maslow to now. Then we're going to rewind the clock, going all the way back, and we're going to follow the same trajectory with the science of spirituality. Then we're going to do this a third time with what we can consider sort of a psychedelic detour. Psychedelics are its own funky category. In the beginning, you go back 150 years, and this was spirituality and high performance rolled into one, and then it sort of got split apart, and now today, sort of coming back together. And finally, the last big sort of chapter of this is going to be the Mapping Cloud 9 section, where we talk about the emerging picture of today's upper possibility space. And here, we're going to do a lot of decoding and application. Things are going to get really practical. So we're going to apply some of the spiritual ideas to the science of high performance, and hopefully you'll come out the other side better performers. And we're going to apply the science of high performance to the spiritual pathway, and so hopefully you'll come out the other side with a richer spiritual practice. And the end goal is that you will have a much more interesting, intriguing, and meaningful life on the back end of this. All right, so I want to jump in with Friedrich Nietzsche. So why are we starting this discussion with Friedrich Nietzsche? You probably are familiar with Nietzsche. You probably read Nietzsche back in high school or in college. Nietzsche's a really good point to jump in, because even though philosophy has long sort of concerned itself with questions of high performance and even questions of spirituality, I'm thinking specifically of the Greeks, Stoic philosophy is a really good, early, great kind of high performance philosophy that's made a big comeback as of lately. But Nietzsche is the first major post-Darwinian philosopher, and that really matters. So 1859, Darwin publishes The Origin of Species, and he brings the entire house of God crumbling down, right? Suddenly, man is no longer created in God's image. Suddenly, man is the byproduct of a random evolutionary process, and we're related to apes, etc., etc. And as a result, Nietzsche's the first kind of post-Darwinian philosopher, and he's part of a growing group of people who went, oh, wow, look, biology evolved, our bodies evolved, I'll bet our brains evolved too. So Nietzsche said, and he says this in his autobiography, he says, who among the philosophers before me was in any way a psychologist? Before me, there was simply no psychology. And what he means is, before me, there was no Darwin. And without Darwin, we didn't know the mind evolved. And because we didn't know the mind evolved in a certain way, we couldn't get a good psychological picture of who we were, who we are, right? And this is also why Nietzsche said, God is dead, right? This is his famous quote. And what he means is he doesn't just mean God is dead, right? He means our big theory ideas about God, capital G, Christianity, Islam, organized religion. But he was also going right at any philosopher who had a perfect world. So Plato's world of forms, right? There's this perfect world of forms that exists out there. It's perfect. Nietzsche was saying, no, it's not. Shut up. Everything is chaotic. Everything evolves. There's no such thing. And he was really pointing at Enlightenment thinkers who thought that the mind of man, aka man and woman, was perfectible. And Nietzsche didn't think this was true at all. Like, he used to talk about Plato. He essentially said Plato was not a big fan of Christianity, as we know, and Nietzsche used to call Plato Christianity for highbrows. So he was really opposed to any of these perfect world systems. Nietzsche thought man was a mess, right? That we weren't evolving in a specific direction, that evolution was random and chance played a role, right? And the thing here that matters is before Nietzsche, right, before Darwin, meaning, purpose in life came from God. Now it has to come from human beings. And this is huge, huge for Nietzsche. Now, a couple other things that Nietzsche thought that are really important, and these ideas are going to come back again and again and again in different forms over the course of our story. So one of Nietzsche's, it's the first in a long line of thinkers who thought culture weighs too much. Right? Freud is probably the most famous of these thinkers. Freud's big idea was, look, mommy weighs a ton, culture weighs a ton. It is really hard to get out from under this stuff. But Nietzsche felt the same way. And when we talk about the weight of culture, the weight of history, and the weight of mommy, we're talking about at an unconscious level, right? At a really deep unconscious level. And this is how it evolves, right? This is Freud's unconsciousness with all its complexes. This is Jung and his archetypes. This is Claude Levi-Strauss, the anthropologist, structural anthropologist, and his deep structures. Noam Chomsky's universal grammar. Jacques Derrida, the postmodern philosopher, his position on language, which plays such a role in today's social justice issues, right? And let me explain what I mean by this. So culture weighs too much and we can't get away from it and it's built in unconsciously. So Derrida argues about language, and this is one of the most mysterious, obfuscated arguments, but what he's saying is actually really simple and precise. He's saying, look, language is synchronic and diachronic. Synchronic means the position of a word at a particular point in time in a current linguistic system it's occupying, meaning a cat is not a dog and it's not a horse, but it's also what we mean by the 21st century of a cat, right? So the definition includes a genus and a species, and it doesn't include, say, things that we used to think about cats 300 years ago that were superstitious, right? So that's the synchronic meaning there's cultural weight inside the language we use to describe reality. So we can't even get past culture when we're trying to describe reality, right? The other problem is diachronic, right? Which is the historical catalog of all the meanings. So if I use the word justice today, right, it means one thing. If I use the word justice 1,000 years ago, it means something else, right? If we use the word justice, you know, in biblical times, it means I can stone my child at the city gates for bad-mouthing mommy and daddy, right? The words mean different things at different times. Culture is buried inside the language. So that was a long, long tangent to get us back to Nietzsche, who basically thought of culture as evolutionary success stories, right? What we think of as culture are just strategies that work. And one of his favorite quotes about this that I love, he said, the past of every form and way of life, of cultures that formerly lay right next to or on top of each other, now flow into us modern souls. Our drives now run back everywhere. We ourselves are a kind of chaos, right? And what he means by we are a kind of chaos is we're an aggregation of intertwined psychological entities. Some of these are unconscious, they're the weight of culture, they're mommy, and some of it are our old ancient instincts, all sort of mashed together into the mess, right? So he doesn't believe we can know everything about our minds. This is really important. He believes in the unconscious, right? And that mommy and culture are heavy there. But the most important thing about Nietzsche is he thought there had to be more going on. He thought we weren't doomed to this, right? And so he wanted to replace the struggle to survival with one of his most misinterpreted terms, the will to power. The will to power has nothing to do with what we think of as power over another human being or power in a political sense. He is talking about our unearthing our true nature and overcoming our true nature, the struggle for self-overcoming, the struggle for self-creation, for self-actualization, for excellence, right? What used to be God or these perfect world things is now man, human beings' duty, right? And so he doesn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, too. He wrote a really great book called Twilight of the Idols, where he said, look, I do philosophy with a hammer. And people thought what Nietzsche meant is I smash things. And he doesn't mean it that way. He means he's going to ring the idols like you would ring a bell. And he's going to see which ones are hollow and which ones have substance. By idols, he means any of the so-called great men. Confucius, Buddha, Moses, Jesus, Plato, Aristotle, right? And what he wants us to do when we think about these people is not think of them as gods, but understand that these were all human beings. So when Jesus was coming up with his ideas, he is a man having brilliant creative insights, exercising his will to power, right? But you have to judge these insights through the lens of science. So when philosophers practice philosophy, in a sense, they're, because the topics are so big and highfalutin, you know, Nietzsche was interested in values and ontology and all these fancy words, they call them, to make it a little more humble, projects. So Nietzsche's project was essentially trying to decode all of these ancient traditions and see what holds up, what doesn't hold up, what makes sense through the lens of science, and what should we look at and say, oh, this is just the culture of the time or the sociology of the time or the politics of the time, and we should strip it out, right? Like in the Jewish dietary laws, nobody looks at the laws of kosher and thinks anymore, this is the word of God. We think, oh, wow, in the era before we really could cook, trichinosis was a problem and you shouldn't eat raw pork or you shouldn't eat shellfish, right? Like this is a health idea disguised as a religious idea. So Nietzsche wants to strip all that stuff out and get to the core ideas. So with all that said, the one thing I also want to say is that Nietzsche is sort of a high romantic. What we would now say about him today is he's spiritual but not religious. He believes, even though that he doesn't believe in these perfect worlds, he does believe in this experience of cosmic unity, of becoming one with everything. That's sort of woven through. So there's a mystical current in Nietzsche underneath all this stuff. But as a general rule, Nietzsche had a really simple formula for high performance. And we're going to do this throughout. And this often gets lost. We hear all these really big kind of fancy philosopher names, and we forget that what they're actually trying to do, a lot of them, is just to help us live better lives, right? So there are actual, especially in Nietzsche, there's a high performance formula. And it's really sort of a four-step formula. And the reason we're going to walk through it is both because I think it's really, really cool and really, really useful. But it's amazing that where we end up 150 years from now, these ideas are still, not only are they incredibly relevant, now they're scientifically validated. That's what's really interesting. And it also means that long before there was any science to back Nietzsche up, right? Long before we had modern neuroscience, modern psychology, modern anything, this dude was right. And it's worth pointing that out. So at the core of what he said is, and this is sort of his recipe for becoming the Übermensch, right? Übermensch was his word for the Superman, right? The overman. And he didn't think really any one person could do this. He thought this was our project as a species to try to evolve into this, right? And what he said is the place you got to start is you got to find your passion and your purpose. Find an organizing idea. This is what Rilke meant by live the questions, right? Rilke was very influenced by Nietzsche, same era roughly. Live the questions. Find a central organizing idea, and then go at attack it creatively. Nietzsche saw art as a fundamental to high performance and as an antidote to nihilism, to world weariness. And he was really concerned about this. Nietzsche pointed out, he said, look, if God is dead and there's no meaning coming from up above, and we got to make it for ourselves. This is really hard. This is really hard. And if we don't make it for ourselves, we are going to fall prey to fascists who serve as the new deities. In other words, Nietzsche saw Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini coming 40 years before they showed up. He was dead on right about everything that was about to come. Out of this, right, comes the will to power, which is the great existentialist mandate, right? We take full responsibility for our choices and we act, we create, and we alone bear the responsibility for our creation. Now, art wasn't just the antidote. Creativity, self-expression, self-actualization, self-discovery wasn't just the antidote to nihilism. He loved it so much because art reminds us of what he called states of animal vigor. And he used a very specific term. He used the term Rausch. Now, Rausch is essentially the ancient German term for flow. It originally comes from Goethe, and it means the acceleration of movement leading to a flowing joy. Now, this is interesting, because what Goethe and Nietzsche are talking about is a subdued, controllable ecstasy and elation. So this isn't like a possession experience, right, where you are overtaken by spirit and you lose control of yourself in Rausch, in flow. This is peak performance. You are at your best. But they also talk about it as there's the separation of high and low is a race. This is we are becoming one with everything, right? They also talked about Rausch as the delight of the inner faculties that lead to self-forgetfulness, right? So this is Csikszentmihalyi's The Vanishing of Self as a fundamental definition to flow just 100 years, literally before Csikszentmihalyi came up with the idea. This is also really cool. Nietzsche was the first, by no means the last, to figure out that flow was ethically neutral, right? There is the Rausch of creativity, and then there's the Rausch of destruction. Nietzsche also pointed out, by the way, that flow or Rausch could be accessed chemically under the influence of certain narcotics, and he talked about it as a strength, a vigor. And his, for there to be art, for there to be any aesthetic doing and seeing, one physiological precondition is indispensable, Rausch. Rausch must first have enhanced the excitability of the whole machine, else there is no art, as Nietzsche said. Now, that's his third point, his fourth point, and this is very Nietzsche, but we're going to see it again and again and again and again. And this is a high-performance tradition that is necessary in the spiritual community and often gets very overlooked in the spiritual community. So one of the things you're going to see as we go along is oftentimes, because these are similar paths, if you're on a high-performance path and you're stuck, you need a spiritual answer. And if you're on a spiritual path and you're stuck, oftentimes you need a high-performance answer, right? And one example is here. And for Nietzsche, he felt that suffering is not optional. He felt that the only way out is through, right? He felt that the measure of a really good life was a life spent suffering. He used to write Christmas cards to his friends that would say things like, "Congratulations, I hear you got gout this year and cancer and lost an eye and had your leg amputated. How fantastic for you." Because of everything that you could learn on the other side of that. One of his favorite descriptions of himself, of when he was talking about himself, Nietzsche used to say, "I am more of a battlefield than a man," which I love. And he also felt that the only way to kind of move through the suffering, again, was the will to power, right? It's creative self-expression. Overcome yourself. Become bigger than you are. Now, the interesting thing here about all this is that Nietzsche also agreed, by the way, with Jung, and we'll see this when we start to talk about Carl Jung a little later. Jung was really clear. He said, yeah, mommy and culture weigh a lot, and you have to overcome them. But after you've overcome them, you got to go right at your darkness, right? Jung called it your shadow side. That's the way forward. Nietzsche absolutely agreed, right? He wrote, and as I said earlier, that Übermensch translates as Superman. So I'm translating out of the German here. And he wrote, "I teach you the Superman. Man is something that should be overcome. What have you done to overcome him?" It's also, with all the fancy language aside, understand all he's saying here, right? What he's saying is passion, purpose, grit, flow, this is the path to high performance. That's really what he's saying. That's how we boil it down. Most importantly, and this is sort of key to Nietzsche, and it shifts back and forth, but it also shows up in a lot of the spiritual traditions. So, give you an example. When I was 18 years old, my first novel is a retelling of an ancient Kabbalistic Jewish story, and a lot of it happened because I went to my rabbi. I was like 17, 18 years old. I was raised Jewish, and I heard about this thing called Kabbalah, and I was intrigued, and I asked my rabbi to explain Kabbalah to me, teach me Kabbalah. And he said, well, you're not 40 years old. You're not a Talmud scholar, not a Torah scholar. I will not teach it to you. This is forbidden knowledge. And I said, screw the rabbi, and wrote a book about it. So Nietzsche felt the same way as my rabbi. He said, high performance is not for everybody. He actually thought less than 10% of the population should actually try high performance. And he was not a fan of most people. He thought most people were... He thought the herd mentality was prevalent. He called them sheep and cows, right? And there were two types of the herd. There was the last man and the slave, right? The last man is governed by the hunt for short-term pleasure, right? This is the mediocre man who is blind to higher values and is just seeking, oh, this glass of wine and this sexual escapade and this television program, and, oh, I can watch Netflix and blah, blah, blah. So wasn't very impressed with the last man. And the other half was the slave, which he thought was worse. And the slave was a mentality where you try to bring people down. You burn out the geniuses. Anytime you see somebody expressing your will to power, right, this is the nail that sticks out, gets hammered down kind of idea, right? And if you worship comfort and conformity, the herd wins. Right, that you needed that lofty goal to rise above. But again, Nietzsche didn't think everybody was capable, but he thought really just maybe 10% of the population could pull this off. Everybody else, not so much, you're sort of screwed. So Nietzsche kicks off our discussion. He did so at a specific point in time, right? He was doing his early work in the 1870s, and I want to just give you a picture of what else is going on in the world, right? So 1873, 1 year after Nietzsche has published his first major work, which is The Birth of Tragedy, a German physiologist named Wilhelm Wundt publishes Principles of Physiological Psychology, which is a big deal. It establishes the field of experimental psychology, right? So the very thing Nietzsche wanted, a rigorous, experimental, evolutionary minded approach to the human mind, Wilhelm Wundt gives us. And it's a big deal because up until this moment in time, psychology had been a part of physiology. It wasn't its own field. Wilhelm Wundt breaks it off. And he introduces a notion that's going to show up again and again and again, which is introspection, right? Looking inward to examine our thoughts, our feelings, our consciousness. This becomes phenomenology. Right? And after Freud essentially swallows psychology for 30 to 40 years. Phenomenology, right? Phenomenology is a fancy way of saying, how does this make me feel? What's going on inside me? So by looking inward, by introducing introspection, you notice that all he's doing is essentially introducing a very Eastern philosophical, spiritual idea into the Western psychological tradition almost at its root, right? And Wundt's big deal in high performance is he starts, through introspection, he starts breaking apart all the little components, habit, attention, all the things, by the way, that they talk about in Eastern meditation traditions, suddenly get introduced into the psychology of high performance. And suddenly we're looking at attention. We're trying to study these things and measure them experimentally. And a great example of this, so this was at a time, by the way, when science and industry were not separated at all. So Wundt, one of his early contracts, he's hired by a German beer manufacturer. And the beer manufacturer wants to know, is there a perfect amount of bitterness in beer that everybody's going to love. So if I can get my beer to this perfect amount of bitterness, I've nailed it. So Wundt does a whole bunch of experiments, and what he discovers is what we now know in physiology as the Erks-Dobson curve, and this is going to come back later when we talk about the neurobiology of flow. But what he discovers is there's a sweet spot for attention, and that below this sweet spot, there's not enough of a stimulus, aka you're bored, you're not paying enough attention to the thing. So if there's bitter in the beer and you can't really notice it's bitter, it's not having an effect, right? And then there's the sweet spot, it's the perfect amount of bitterness or the perfect amount of whatever sensation. And above that, whoa, way too much, it's anxiety, it's freaking me out, there's too much bitterness, I don't like how this tastes, or I don't like, this noise is too loud. In between is a sweet spot. Psychologists now talk about that sweet spot as the flow channel. And it turns out when we get to flow hacking and how to produce this state of consciousness at will, this sweet spot discovered way back when a guy was looking for the perfect bitter beer, turns out to be a really big key. So psychology, Nietzsche's doing his work. He's saying, hey, we need a science of spirituality in a sense. We need a science of high performance. It's got to be based on evolution. It's got to be based on experiment. And Wundt comes along and does just that. Now, simultaneously, right, the science of spirituality is getting kicked off, and it's getting kicked off by a guy named Albert Heim. Now, if you've read my book, Rise of Superman, you may be familiar with Heim's story. I want to retell it here because it's so important. The year is 1871, and Heim is a Swiss geologist, and he's going to go on later in his life. He's going to do really foundational work on the geological structure of the Alps, and he's going to be a member of the Oxford Royal Society. Back then, he is still making a name for himself. It's 1871, and he and his brother and three friends, and they set out, and they're going to climb the Santis, which is the 12th highest peak in Switzerland. Now, all five men had been playing in the Alps since they were children, but none of them were considered experienced mountaineers because the issue is historical. No one back then was an experienced mountaineer, right? The first recorded climb in history, mountaineering expedition, belongs to Emperor Hadrian. It's 121 AD, and he scampers up Mount Etna to watch the sunrise, right? The modern birth of mountain climbing is often dated to a guy named Sir Alfred Willis, who in 1854 went up the Wetterhorn. The funny thing, by the way, is that he's not often credited with it. Other people had actually been to the top of that peak, other Germans, but Alfred was an Englishman, and the English were then keeping score. So Willis's contract sort of marks the birth of systematic mountaineering, the birth of what's known as the Golden Age of Alpinism. It's a decade-long stretch where most of the first peaks in the Alps are climbed. Heim doesn't arrive in time for the Golden Age of alpinism. He's a few years too late, so there are no peak bagging exploits credited his name. In fact, he's not remembered at all for contributing to mountaineering history, but he is remembered as the point that history took a turn for the weird. So Heim is high up on the Santis, and he is trying to cross a snowy ridge, and a blizzard has blown in, and he can no longer see straight, and he's in the middle of this rocky ledge. The way forward is down a dicey slope, steep, it's narrow, there's cliffs on all sides. All five people, they're arguing, they don't know what to do, should they go forward, should they go back, right? And Heim decides he's going to set out, and in the moment he steps forward, the wind blows, pulls his hat off his head, without trying to think about it, he tries to snatch it back, right? This motion unbalances him, right? And the angle of the perch does the rest. He falls sideways, he flips upside down, he spins around backwards, and before anyone can react, he's rocketing towards the lip of the cliff with no way to slow down. His ice axe is out of reach, right? He tries driving his hands into the ground, but his skull keeps slamming into rocks, his finger gets ground to pulp, and even before the pain can register, he is airborne. And while his actual flight covered 60 feet and lasted a few more seconds, that was not Heim's experience at all. The first thing he had noticed is he had dropped out of normal waking state reality into an entirely other dimension. His senses are heightened. His vision feels panoramic. Time has slowed to an absolute crawl, right? And he can see his brother, he can see his friends, he can see the horrified look on their faces as they see what's going on. But as he later explained, he felt no anxiety, no trace of despair or pain, rather a calm seriousness, a profound acceptance, and a dominant mental quickness. And with his life unfolding in slow motion, Heim has time to survey the entire territory and make rescue plans. He imagines scenarios for smite injuries and serious injuries and where he's going to land and how he's going to bounce and how his companions are going to get down to his body. And then he thinks, oh, I'll be dead and they won't be able to find my body and I'll be unable to deliver the lecture I'm supposed to give at Oxford University a few days from now. Oh my God, it's my first major Oxford lecture and they're going to need to find a substitute. And then he says goodbye to his friends and his family and he's still falling. And then he realizes that if he survives his fall, he's going to need to wake himself up and clear his head. So he's got vinegar for just this purpose in his backpack, in his rucksack. And then, as he later recounted, I heard a dull thud and my fall was over. Haim survived the impact, but the mystery of what happened never left him. Panoramic vision, time dilation, heavenly music, none of it made any sense, right? And he's a scientist by training, so he decides he wants to investigate this. And he does what becomes the first study of near-death experiences ever undertaken, right? And he finds 32 other climbers, all of whom who have survived near-fatal accidents. And a staggering 95% of this study group reported similar weird events, right? What was causing them is going to be a matter of really long debate, but it's the first scientific investigation that determines, first of all, high-risk activity can have a profound impact on consciousness, right, and can improve our mental states, right? He was incredibly clear-headed in his thinking, right? He writes this up in 1892 in a monograph called Remarks on Fatal Falls. And historians still consider it, as I mentioned, the first written account of near-death experiences. But the term is really misleading. A lot of Haim subjects reported these profoundly altered states without actually being in real jeopardy. They only thought they were in life-threatening situations, and that's the key detail, right? If these experiences are mystical, if they only arose in dire straits, right, when our life is on the line, then perhaps they really were communications from beyond the beyond. But if it's perception and psychology that are the triggers, meaning I wasn't actually in a life-threatening situation, I just thought I was in a life situation, then the puzzle is more physiological than paranormal. And that opens the door for a lot of really interesting possibilities. So everything I talk about as the science of spirituality is the exploration of those interesting possibilities. So one of the first to know these possibilities and one of my great heroes is the Harvard philosopher, psychologist, and physician William James. So the philosopher Alfred Whitehead once said, there are four great Western thinkers, Plato, Aristotle, Leibniz, and William James. For a long time, he was definitely the most famous psychologist in the world. He sort of got replaced by Freud, but he is absolutely a high-performance philosopher in the Nietzsche tradition and an experimentalist in the Wundt tradition. And by experimentalist, like, I just want you to understand kind of the time and the era and what they got to work with. So he also picked up Wundt's introspection technique, and he notices that consciousness is actually a stream of consciousness. It's made up of these discrete moments, these bits, particles, not waves, to use a physics analogy, right? And so he wonders, how long is the now? How long are these particles, right? So he runs this great early experiment in timing the now. He's got a stopwatch, pocket watch, actually. His time is thoughts, and he decides that the now lasts 12 to 30 seconds, depending on what's going on. Mostly it's about 12 seconds. And one of the reasons I mention this is this study has been repeated and repeated and repeated, and this guy in the 1880s, sitting in a room with a watch, time is thoughts, came up with 12 seconds, and now 150 years later, we've got atomic clocks we can measure down to the whatever. Turns out the now is 14 seconds long on average. He was off by 2 seconds, which is not bad. He also, James is an amazing, amazing character. He's had an amazing, amazing life. His father is this incredibly eccentric theologian. The whole world, Emerson, Thoreau, passes through his Boston home, all of them. His brother is Henry James, the novelist, right? And his brother is something of a problem for William as he's growing up. By the time Henry was 19, he's already writing, and he's getting famous by the time he's like 26. At this time, James doesn't have a clue what he wants to do with his life. He eventually goes to Harvard, but back then, Harvard was a brand new institution, and it was crazy. The faculty was random. James later said that just living through the experience was a big deal. This is not the Harvard that we think of today, right? And he studies physiology and philosophy, but what he wants to study is psychology, but it's not yet a field. And James actually is the man who convinces the dean of Harvard at that time that he should be able to teach a class in what becomes psychology. So he's often talked about as the godfather of American psychology. And he wrote, published in 1890, we're going to talk more about this in a second, the very first psychology textbook. But more importantly, what I want to start with James is he comes out of Harvard and he has a serious bout of depression. And it's bad. Panic attacks, hallucinations, can barely get out of bed. And his father later in his life suffered the same problem. And James, usually influenced by Darwin, right, is worried that biology is destiny, that he actually has no control of his life, and that the depression, they're never going anywhere. They're just going to get worse and worse and worse. And he concludes that free will itself is an illusion. And he stays in bed for years. And then in 1870, he reads an essay by Charles Renouvier, and something in the essay works. Everything starts to calm down, and he has this insight. He decides, because he's been put into this panic by the fact that he doesn't have free will, he decides he's going to believe in free will. He's going to test out his belief in free will by believing in free will, or as he said, my first act of free will shall be to believe in free will. And the crazy thing is it works. James feels better, a lot better. He gets out of bed. He gets back to Harvard. He gets his life back. He becomes one of the world's greatest thinkers. And it leads him to what I think of as his first sort of great conclusion. The great thing then in all education is to make our nervous system our ally instead of our enemy. And this idea is, I think, the foundation of kind of the modern science of high performance, right? And he is very scientific about it, but he's also, James is incredibly open-minded. And as we'll see in a minute, he's very open-minded to a lot of spiritual ideas. And he is trying to hold, just like Nietzsche tried to hold, both the kind of the spiritual side and the scientific side at once. And this is a really famous quote by James when he was talking about sort of this idea. The point which as evolutionists we are bound to hold fast to is that all the new forms of being that make their appearance are really nothing more than the results of the redistribution of unchanging materials. The selfsame atoms which, chaotically dispersed, made the nebula, now jammed and temporally caught in peculiar positions, form our brains. And the evolution of the brain, if understood, would be simply the account of how the atoms came to be so caught and jammed. In this story, no new natures, no factors not present at the beginning, are introduced at any later stage. But with the dawn of consciousness, an entirely new nature seems to slip in, something whereof the potency was not given in the mere outward atoms of the original chaos. Right, he's saying there's a mystery here. Something else is going on.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode with a special of Mapping Cloud 9. Let us know on social if you did, and we'll get more of these in. We'll get more snippets out of audiobooks into the podcast for you. Now, if you want to discover what is stopping you from experiencing flow states, then I recommend taking our free flow blocker diagnostic at flowblocker.com. It takes about 3 minutes to complete, and you'll learn what is stopping you from dropping into flow. Which of the 10 flow blockers it is that's tripping you up, whether that's motivation or procrastination or overwhelm, we'll figure it out, and we will give you some super actionable advice to help unblock you from flow so that you can get back in the swing of things as quickly as possible. So head over to flowblocker.com to check it out and figure out what your flow blocker is. And finally, I've got a quick favor for you. So if you've been enjoying what you've been hearing at Flow Research Collective Radio, then please do us a super solid one and leave us a review. Our team reads all the reviews. I read most of the reviews, as does Stephen, and we always appreciate it a ton. We will share your review on social, and every review lets us get the podcast out to more people by doing all sorts of funky things with the iTunes algorithm. So we'd appreciate it a ton if you'd take 2 seconds and do that. And I appreciate you very much for listening to Flow Research Collective Radio, and I'm excited to catch you on the next episode. We got lots of cool ones coming soon, so stay tuned, and I'll catch you there.